Tyson said, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. There's my notes. Carefully completed, printed out last night. What can you see on there, Rick?
A lot of scribbles.
Everybody has a plan. I often used to sing with the choir down at St. Mark's, and I often used to lead choral matins there. When you lead choral matins, there are sung responses. So you, as the leader, sing the first part, and the congregation respond with the second part. In some churches, especially cathedrals, the person leading the service often doesn't lead the responses. There is a chorister, a cantor, who sings those responses. Now, when I was given this reading from Carl and the title to go with it, I was a little puzzled. It seemed to me that the orphan was almost tacked on to the end of the reading. So we need to unpack as we go and see why it is a significant part. Coming out of the vestry at St. Mark's this morning, I noticed on the organ case, just as you come out of the vestry into the chancel, there is a prayer posted on the wall. It goes like this. Grant that what we sing with our lips, we may believe in our hearts, and what we believe in our hearts, we may show forth in our lives. That prayer sprang into my mind when I read through this passage from James. I looked it up. It's called the Chorister's Prayer. It dates back probably to the 13th century. It even gave me the original Latin. And fortunately, a translation. Now, I've read you the English version. This is what the Latin says. See that, not grant that, see that, it's addressed to the chorister. See that what you sing with your mouth, you believe with your heart. And what you believe with your heart, prove it by works. That's a bit more direct than we may show forth in our lives. Prove it by works, says the chorister's prayer. Prove it by works. James would have loved this. So, let's have a look, see what we've got. A central theme of James's letter is a transition from words to belief to action. Words to belief to action, just like the prayer. What we sing with our lips, when we believe in our hearts, what we believe in our hearts, prove it by works. So I'm going to follow through James's description in these verses of that three-stage process. But first we need to know who James was writing to and for. It doesn't look as though this letter was addressed to a particular church. A lot of Paul's letters are addressed to a particular church and have greetings to particular people. This doesn't. It seems to be addressed to a Jewish church because it's got lots of Old Testament references. And it seems to be addressed to a church that is poor, that is oppressed by outsiders, that is denied justice by its wealthy neighbours. But despite those things, it seems this church is drifting into worldliness. It shows great deference to the wealthy. It shows a callous disregard for the poor. It shows an arrogance, a selfish ambition, where church members felt free to openly criticise others. James saw this condition as reflecting a failure to put faith into action. And he drew on that church's Jewish heritage to bring to the fore a vision of what religion should be, of what their faith should be. Now, James saw faith as composed of those three elements we've already talked about. Let's just see what he says about them. First, receiving the word. James contrasts receiving the word in humility with speaking out in anger. Quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger. Jewish wisdom literature placed a great emphasis on measured speech, on careful listening. To receive the truth, we have to listen. We cannot merely hear. We have to listen. We take our time. We turn it over in our minds. We are measured in our response to the word. Secondly, believing. Only when we truly listen, says James, can we assimilate what we have heard, draw it into our inmost being, into our heart, into our spirit, our soul. We believe in our spirits. Finally, thirdly, doing. As we assimilate that good news, so we let it shape our character, until the natural result is a life lived out according to that character. You might have been a little puzzled here by James's reference to an image in the mirror and forgetting that image. We know pretty well what we look like. We're surrounded by mirrors. We might not like what we see in the mirror, but we see it often. We can be under no illusions as to what we look like. It was not like that in the first century. Through a mirror darkly, wrote Paul. Because they didn't have splendid mirrors. They had a polished piece of metal, or maybe piece of glass polished. It was easy to forget what you looked like. It probably wasn't important to them. It sounds quite good to me. But for James's readers, the possibility of not remembering what you look like was not an outrageous thing to say. It was a possibility. Because they weren't reminded all the time. Every shop window, the front of the wardrobe, you know, the mirror on the wall in the living room. It's everywhere. We see what we look like. So James was saying, you need this in your faith. You need to be reminded what faith looks like. So James is encouraging his readers to listen carefully, to assimilate the word, because that reminds them what faith looks like. Looking in the mirror of the word will remind you of the truth which can mould your character. And finally, having gone through the three steps, James fleshes out with an example. Pure religion, pure faith, he says, follows the principles of justice as epitomised by our treatment of the widow and the orphan. Now, just as the notion of a mirror wouldn't have been the same for his readers as it is for us, so the notion of the widow and orphan needs unpacking too. You may be sort of familiar with the idea of the widow and the orphan. They form part of a trio which occurs throughout Scripture. The widow, the orphan or the fatherless, and the alien or stranger or foreigner, those three, run through the Old Testament like a thread of silver in a piece of fabric. You look through the Old Testament, you'll find them in Exodus, in Deuteronomy, in Isaiah, Ruth, Job, Psalms, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Zechariah, Amos. Wherever you look, you will find that trio. So in Jewish history, we can see this trio as being emblematic of those that society marginalises. The poor, those with no social standing, no rights, no access to justice. Many of those Old Testament references show God as the protector and defender of those helpless people. And others exhort us to do likewise. I'm just going to read a couple, and I'm hoping that Steve and Paul between them have got these for me. Deuteronomy chapter 10. For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality and accepts no bribes. Doesn't that make you wonder what society the writer of these words was living in? That it is remarkable that a powerful being accepts no bribes and shows impartiality. And we go on. He defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow and loves the alien, giving him food and clothing. And you are to love those who are aliens, for you yourselves were aliens in Egypt. At the beginning of Isaiah, in the first chapter, Isaiah is passing on God's words. Let's have a look. I've got a little bit before that. I might not have given them enough verses. But let me start you off. I think, when you spread out your hands in prayer, says God, I will hide my eyes from you. Even if you offer many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood. Wash and make yourselves clean. Take your evil deeds out of my sight. Stop doing wrong, start doing right. Seek justice, encourage the oppressed, defend the cause of the fatherless, plead the case of the widow. There's passion here. This is not dry scripture. This is a passion. It is God's passion for the most oppressed in our society, in any society. And that passion over the millennia has spilt out into wider society. God's passion for a just society which takes care of its weakest members. We could kind of see the roots of this approach for the Jews themselves in the years in the wilderness, in the desert. In the desert, solitary existence is almost impossible. In the desert, a place full of imagery from the Old Testament, full of meaning for the Jew. It's a place of hardship, but it's a place where we meet God. If you like, it's a place of poverty in the physical sense, but in the spiritual sense, it is a place of richness. There is, you might like to know, a whole branch of Jewish theology dedicated to the relationship between poverty and piety. Why do we think there are so many brotherhoods and sisterhoods in the Christian church that are dedicated to poverty? Because in that they see that the corrosive influence of wealth is stripped away. But the just society, I think, is characterized by kindness. Now, this is a word that's loosely used and has become wishy-washy, but I think kindness is the greatest of the virtues. It is the most underrated. It is how you treat other people. It could be aptly summed up in verses that you know, I'm sure, all of you, extremely well. Love God and love your neighbour as yourself. And when pressed with a follow-up question, who is my neighbour? Jesus told the parable of the Good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan, the alien in our midst, the foreigner, the stranger, one of the trio. So James is exhorting his readers to support the transition from hearing the word to believing, to nurturing that belief so that we may be moulded more and more into the likeness of God, in whose image, after all, we were fashioned. The proof of this pudding, James says, is how we regard and treat other people. Now that might sound straightforward, but get your mindset back to the Good Samaritan. How you treat other people is not about your friend that you're sitting next to. It's about the people you don't like. It's about the people you're frightened of. It's about the people you disapprove of. Those are the people that form part of that emblematic trio. They are the poverty stricken, the oppressed. They are the widow, the orphan, and the alien. How we regard them, then, is critical. It is a development of our Christian character that follows through from those three phases, hearing or reading or singing or work. You probably don't realise it, but you say or sing the Psalms every week. Every service you come to here, I can guarantee you, you will be singing Psalms. You might think it's a song by an Australian songwriter. Chances are, it's a bit of a psalm. Engage with the word by whatever means necessary. That's why all these scribbles are on here. Because I sat through a service at St. Mark's and then came here and sat through a cup of coffee while I waited and sat and heard other people praying about this service. I have to say, most of my response to that was help. Help. And he does. And I've got all these extra things to say. But come down to the bottom line. Follow through. Engage with the word. Let it seep into you. Expect that it will change you. Expect that it will make you want to act. Action without that impetus from the truth of your salvation is empty. Let it flow. That's just the start, how we treat other people. This is an element of godliness that God longs to see in us. He's passionate about it. We should be. But the question is, I ask myself, and we all should, am I up to it? With his help? Yes.